In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
There are so many ways in Washington to say no. There's so many ways to kill an idea. There's so much risk aversion in how we operate, that it's a Herculean feat to do anything major. But when it happens, when you do a sustained mobilization that isn't just a presidential campaign, but continues to fight, which you've done for cash relief, then you see that things can get done and can change. And so I have admiration for your supporters that they've stuck with this, stuck with you, and have gotten more engaged, more involved after your campaign than just saying, okay, we did our thing and we made our contribution to this country.
I'm reflecting on the fact that, look, if 55% of us are for universal basic income, problem solved, right? And then it's like problem not solved at all because of the stuff that you're describing.
Welcome back. It's the next episode of Yang Speaks. It's good to be with you all. Thank you for tuning in. Ro Khanna is joining this episode. This episode's going to be amazing. So thanks for being here. I'm Zach Grauman. I was Andrew Yang's campaign manager for our presidential run in 2020, and I'm your co-host of Yang Speaks. First things first, guys, check out the new digs. I know it's not great. You guys have been trashing me hilariously on Twitter about my backdrop. I agree, it's not been great, and it's not done yet. Still a work in progress. But you got me, like, a little better. Thank you all for those of you who tuned in to our first episode of our limited series, The Future Of. We did The Future of Buying in E-commerce last Thursday. Thursday episodes are back, folks! Get ready! Get excited! The feedback's been really positive, so thank you all for that and for the love. So tune in every Thursday for Thursday episodes on our future. And this week we're talking about why Texas, the entire state, just froze over. Why there's snow and ice and problems in Texas. It's the climate change episode, folks. The future of energy. So we've got professors on who are experts in carbon capture. I've got experts who are in the global health effects of climate change. And I've got a Forbes 30 Under 30 entrepreneur who's built one of the first power plants that can capture the energy burned from coal way more efficiently. Really exciting conversation. You guys are going to love it. So that's this Thursday. Thursday episodes are back. Get excited. That's number one. Number two, speaking of Texas, I hope you all got a good laugh, a very dark laugh, I guess, on Cancun Cruise. So those of you, in case you haven't noticed this, heard about this, Senator Ted Cruz, yes, the same senator who's said he would play Andrew one-on-one in basketball and then just bailed. He bailed again. He, in the middle of this historic crisis in Texas, we've got millions without power and water and heat, just left to Cancun, just up and left, which is ridiculous. Now, look, I don't want to judge people on what they do to protect their family, you know, within the bounds of the law. So people do what they can to protect the situation they're in, and that is fine. But when you're an elected official, the rules are different, okay? The expectations are different. We literally elected you to deal with this type of thing, to lead in times of crisis. So for you to leave, that's literally not doing your job the only time when it really, really matters. That to me was so infuriating, and he's taken a lot of heat for it. That is well, well, well deserved. And the reality is this. Say what you want about Beto O'Rourke, and I don't agree with everything and that he, you know, all of his policies, if you will, but he never would have left Texas. Never. And hasn't now. Now, sadly, any press is good press in this day and age. So, God forbid. This probably helps Ted Cruz in the long run in terms of his, like, electability and popularity and name ID. But still absurd. And for those of you in the Yang Gang or those of you who are listening in that are in Texas, we are praying for you. I'm donating to causes that can help particularly those less fortunate. I have a good friend. I have a number of good friends in Texas. And one of them said, she said, I was like, how are you doing? Are you guys holding up okay? She said, Zach, imagine being a girl going outside in negative 14 degrees or 14 degrees outside. I don't know. Freezing cold. It's sleeting and you're trying to pee standing up in the wind. She's like, it's been a disaster. But that said, she said, look, we were fortunate enough to have a home and a fireplace and blankets and have access to food. And a lot of people don't have that same luxury. So it's rough for us, but we are fine. There's millions of families, hundreds of thousands of families really struggling. So our prayers are going out to you. And I believe help is on the way, where Joe Biden, I believe, just declared a federal emergency funds to the state of Texas. So hopefully aid is getting to those who need it most. And for those of you in Texas, we are praying for you and hopefully trying to help you as much as we can. Speaking of help, the third thing I wanted to talk about, guys, I just wanted to pause because we haven't done this enough. And I just want to say to the Yang Gang and those of you who supported Andrew, particularly early on, I just want to say I love you. I just want to say I freaking love you. It hasn't been a fun year, particularly. We lost the presidential election, then COVID hit, and this community and family that, look, it wasn't perfect, but it was us. It was love. It was full of the right things, full of humanity first and a belief in something bigger than us. And it felt ripped apart a bit. And a very stressful time, a stressful election that happened. And here we are now, and you've got press hitting Andrew like every day, you know, and even me at times getting our names dragged through the mud. It's all day, every day. And it's during this, so many of you have reached out to Andrew, have posted online, have reached out to me, and you've sent love and you've sent positivity. And I just wanted to say, I love you. And Andrew loves you and we appreciate it. We love you right back. And look, the bottom line is Andrew Yang and myself have always, always, always done this and are doing this right now for the right reasons. And that reason is simple. We want to save our country. We want to save the country we love, the people we love in it, and leave a better place for our kids, something we can be proud of for our children and their children. And that has not changed from day one. Now, I promise you, it would be a lot easier to just go, frankly, like go back into the corporate America and make money. Or be an entrepreneur. It is a lot easier to do that, frankly, but that wouldn't solve what we're fighting for. And so I wanted to say I love you guys and stay strong. Eyes on the prize. Stephen Covey says keep the main thing is keep the main thing the main thing. And that's the main thing, folks. We're trying to save the world. I love you to death. Thank you. And those of you like trash talk me on Twitter, fine. Love you too. I love you guys. Let's bring on Ro Khanna. Ro Khanna is represented from California's 17th district. We love Ro. We had a lot of similar supporters. He has a lot of support in the tech community and the Asian community, just like us. He was the co-chair for Bernie Sanders' 2020 presidential campaign. And one of the few who actually stood up and said, where's the $2,000 check to all Americans during COVID? And oh, God forbid, if that does not happen, we will be very, very upset. But Ro Khanna has been in our camp. He's a great man. It's a great interview. You're going to love it. It's a conversation about the inner workings of politics and what's going on in our political world today. So enjoy it. Ro Khanna joins Yang Speaks.
This podcast is sponsored by Helix Sleep. I have always been a mattress guy. I thought if you're going to spend 8 hours doing something, you should pay attention to what you're doing it on. That's why I love the Helix Sleep product. It is made for me. I am someone who sleeps on my back. I do not sleep hot. I like a firm mattress. And so when I took the Helix Sleep quiz, I wound up with a Helix Dawn model. And it's been fantastic, not just for me, but for my kids who seek it out of the entire house. Don't want to take my word for it? Helix has been awarded the number one mattress pick by GQ and Wired magazine, and they have a 100-night free trial and 10 to 15-year warranties baked in. That's confidence in your product, and if you get on a Helix Sleep mattress, you will see why they are so confident. Helix is offering 20% off all mattress orders and two free pillows for our listeners. Go to helixsleep.com/yang and use code HELIXPARTNER20. This is their best offer yet, and it won't last long. With Helix, better sleep starts now.
It is my pleasure and privilege to welcome to Yank Speaks my good friend, one of the great hopes for the country, Congressman representing Silicon Valley, co-chair of the Bernie Sanders campaign, freaking public policy genius, fighter for the people, Ro Khanna. Welcome, Ro.
Well, Andrew, the admiration is mutual, and you've helped put the idea of giving monthly checks on people's radar. I remember when you were running on that and people mocked you, and now it has become the consensus opinion in this country that how we should address it. So you certainly have been vindicated in one of the many things you've advocated for.
Well, thank you, Ro. You always saw it. You and I were connected before my presidential run, and you were one of the people I was trying to expand the benefits of Silicon Valley to different parts of the country. You drafted the Internet Bill of Rights, which is a fantastic bill that, you know, I certainly hope becomes law. Pretty much, like, I'm a fan of so many of your bills. And one of the things I want to talk about today is really how people can help you get some of these bills passed, because you and I, like, if people watching or listening to this, to the extent that you're fans of mine, if you can imagine me in Congress, like, that's pretty much Ro. Like, Ro's just there, like, hatching up policies and everything else. But let's give people a chance to get to know you a little bit better. And you and I have a lot in common, too. We're also in our mid-40s, children of immigrants. You know, you also went to law school. But how did you arrive in Congress in California? Because that's a very unusual position to find yourself in.
So I grew up in Pennsylvania. My folks are still there in Bucks County. After law school, I had a professor, Larry Lessig, who you may know wrote Code.
We love Larry Lessig. He's been on the podcast.
So he was, I never had him for class, but I was a research assistant for him. And he just kind of offhandedly said, look, the most interesting thing, the intersection of technology and law and policy, is out in the Valley. You ought to come out here. And I went out. I had a job at a law firm as a summer associate at Wilson Sonsini that did tech work. And I was just so intrigued by the place and the possibilities, and never left. So that's how I made it out there. It also happens to be that in Fremont, they actually play cricket. And I said, where else in the country do you have all these cultures, all these people from all over the world? So that's what drew me out there. And then it's a great honor to be able to represent the place in Congress.
You skipped over a bunch of stuff too, man. Weren't you like Deputy Assistant Secretary of Commerce under Obama and some other pretty major milestones in there?
Well, so the run I'm actually proudest of, which I lost 72-19, is my I ran against the war in Iraq and against the Patriot Act, against an incumbent in my own party in my late 20s. And it was a protest run. But my grandfather, as you know, had spent years in jail with Gandhi during the Indian independence movement. And so I've always been very passionate about human rights. And I thought the Iraq War was a disaster. The Patriot Act, which was profiling at the time South Asians, was really something that I opposed. And after that, I got involved in the community with the party, supported President Obama. You know, interestingly enough, I had worked on Obama's first campaign when he was running for the state Senate. By worked, I mean probably spent 4 hours knocking on doors or standing outside a shopping center. It didn't dawn on me until much later in my life that he had already had that race won. And he just had some students basically doing the formality of outreach. But anyway, I had a letter which he had signed probably to every student who had done anything for him. And I sent that in along with my everything else. And so I tell people it's really easy to go work for the president. You just, when you're in college, have to figure out who's going to be president in 15 years and get them to work on one of their campaigns. So maybe they'll work on one of your campaigns. And but circumstance led me to commerce. And the reality is, you know, with all these positions is, yes, you have to be passionate, but you also have to have the confidence of the presidential team. But I loved my job. It was all about bringing manufacturing back, increasing exports. I worked under Gary Locke. One of the things I say is, you know, we would send Gary Locke to negotiate with China. China wasn't sending an American, someone of American origin to negotiate with us.
Gary Locke and I spoke just 2 days ago, believe it or not. You know, he's been a role model of mine for obvious reasons, because he's like the first Asian American governor of Washington and a lot of other, and the Secretary of Commerce. So I guess he was your boss for a little while before you went back to Congress and then ran for Congress, won, and now you've been doing phenomenal work. I will say, Ro, and at the time you and I weren't as friendly as we are now, but I was a little hurt when you chose Bernie over me.
Well, you didn't do a war powers resolution with me, Andrew. I mean, if you were in Congress and we had tried to stop the Yemen war together, you know, I would have picked you.
Perhaps. Oh, I see how it is. You and Bernie there try to pass laws, try to keep the U.S. out of wars. And just because I wasn't there, you didn't know. I'm kidding.
But one of my favorite moments for the presidential debate is when you told Elizabeth Warren, you're so excited Elizabeth Warren had read your book. And I thought, what a moment of humanity, because I'm in the process of writing the book and I had the same thought. I'd love it. I'd be thrilled if Elizabeth Warren read my book or Bernie Sanders. And so it was this, I don't know if you remember the moment, but
oh,
you
I
had
remember.
This kind of genuine excitement.
Don't worry. I remember that moment. So you're writing a book. That's very exciting. Can you share what it's about?
Sure. It's actually about expanding access to the digital economy in rural communities and Black and brown communities, but more broadly also applying the principles of democracy to the digital age. This idea that the social media platforms, that just by creating platforms of communication that we'd somehow have more deliberation or peace, has turned out not to be true, partly because they've targeted us.
You mean the social media companies haven't made us all smarter, Ro? We're not all like much more sophisticated and educated?
Unfortunately not, but it's the early stages, right? I mean, the interesting thing with the printing press, you go back, you look at the history, it took like hundreds of years where the printing press actually, because of written works, was leading to reactions of actually war and conflict. And it took building of liberal institutions to now come to a consensus that the printing press obviously is a great dissemination of knowledge, but that it wasn't also creating violent reactions. So we're just 20 years into social media. It could be enormous in organizing, but we've got to think through what are the forms of communication, the rules of communication, and how do we give people more choice and not have targeting based on our data in the ways that Facebook has been doing it.
Well, that's one of the things you're trying to solve for with your Internet Bill of Rights. So you're in the midst of this in a way that very few others are. My sense of things is that there are some very well-intended legislators like yourself who understand what's going on with our data that is getting sold and resold in ways that are bad for democracy, bad for our mental health, bad economics, and that, you know, it's worth hundreds of billions of dollars and we're not seeing a dime. The financial incentives are not serving us well. And then you have your home state of California that's actually the leader in consumer data rights. My sense of things is that this legislation is kind of stuck in Congress, and that it's more likely that various states end up following California's lead than that Congress passes something that mirrors the California Privacy Act. Is that accurate? Because I'm sure you have your finger on the pulse of what the legislation looks like. And I hope I'm wrong, because I'd be thrilled if there were federal legislation.
We may get federal legislation with Schakowsky, but let me go into some detail here, because I know you and your listeners will appreciate it. Here's the challenge with both the GDPR in Europe and California's consumer rights, and why we need a beefed up FTC and FCC and the federal government to act. One, look at the European fines. I mean, yesterday or a couple of days ago, I read that Italy found that Facebook misused their data. So they're fining him $7 million. I mean, give me a break. Facebook's
not going
to sneeze.
You know, you saw Illinois, there was a civil settlement for $650 million, which at least like would hit their radar screen. But
$7 million would never hit their radar screen. You know, I mean, it's an intern would notice a $7 million fine. The second thing is, and this is the more important thing, is so when they have these consent, it turns out there was this paper done that these tech companies have been able, through graphics and placement, basically get people to click on yes, I consent almost 80-90% of times.
Oh,
by
God.
The way,
no one knows what we're agreeing to. None of us. Yeah. I mean, you and I went to law school. We still have no idea what we're agreeing to half the time.
Exactly. And so even with all the good language that you've got, so what does this mean? We actually need like tech competent people in enforcement agencies, after the FTC, after the FCC, and we've got to have them at the table in defining these laws. I don't think a state-by-state approach or just the European approach is going to be any match for these companies. And I see them. They're in my district. And so we absolutely need federal legislation. But more than that, we need the enforcement and tech-competent people in those agencies who can say, no, you can't have manipulative design, these dark patterns that basically are manipulating people into consent.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/decide. That's linkedin.com/decide. Terms and conditions apply.
What do you see as the prospects of federal legislation and these enforcement resources that could actually balance the scales? Because I agree with you that right now government is outgunned.
Well, I think it's going to take more people caring about it, right? For so long, it was just, that's just a techie issue. It's just privacy. Why should I care about privacy? Here's why you should care, because 64% of people on Facebook who joined QAnon were there with Facebook recommendations to join. You're now on these public
forums. Facebook made some money off of it. Yeah, the whole thing is messed up.
So if you care about the radicalization of our country and the polarization on social media, we've got to care about how our information is being used, not just because of your privacy, because your privacy decision affects the state of our democratic discourse. And so the reason we don't have action on this, frankly, is we don't have the mobilization. No one is out there on my very few people are calling me and saying, bro, we need privacy legislation. We need social media regulated. They're calling me and saying, understandably, we need $15 minimum wage and other issues. But until we have mobilization, this is just going to continue to be stalled.
I'm 100% with you that most people don't understand the urgency of federal data and privacy legislation and enforcement resources, because right now the tech companies are running circles around everybody. And there's not even like a principled debate that's happening that is accurate at all. Like, most legislatures just don't understand the set of issues.
But one thing I really admired about your presidential campaign is you had a clear theory of the case, which I happen to share, which is in part that we're going through a digital revolution that is fundamentally transforming society. It's leaving communities out of wealth generation and out of the possibility of staying in their own communities and doing well. And it's also making it much more difficult to have democratic conversation. But it's sort of like we're going and attacking discrete parts of the issue without seeing that there's this huge
central disease in the middle of it, man. The central, right. like the social media networks, like this tentacle beast in the middle of the whole thing. If someone wanted to help, would it be helpful if they were to reach out to their member of Congress and say, hey, like, get behind this federal data legislation? Like, what can the average citizen do?
Absolutely. So Schakowsky's bill is the bill on privacy legislation that would get passed, and it's still being worked on. But I think just being part of the conversation and saying this is something that we ought to care about, and having ideas, sending us the ideas for that, and insisting that this should be part of the agenda for 2022, that this has to be a high priority.
Let's do it, people. Write your members of Congress. Let them know that you think the Fed should pass legislation protecting our data rights and making it so that there's actual enforcement of those rights, and that's not the tech companies laughing all the way to the bank. So that's one thing you're working on, but that's not even the main thing. You're working on trying to get cash out to people. Is that correct? Which obviously I am 100% behind.
Well, you helped with helping Tim Ryan and I conceive of this. We were calling for this in March with your advocacy at Help, which said, let's get people $2,000 checks. Partly, I read one of the most compelling studies, which is that so many people, I think I read up to 75% of people who are unemployed aren't getting the unemployment benefits. And I had to reread it to really get that.
I'm sure that's true. Out, yeah, it's shocking.
Yeah, but people either don't know about it or don't have the wherewithal to be able to get them. So the best way is just get people these checks. They will spend it locally. They'll make sure their houses aren't getting foreclosed on. They'll be able to help with rent or help the small business landlords. I mean, a lot of people who aren't paying the rent, we're forgetting about the small businesses that are being hurt. So I don't understand why, if we find these trillions of dollars to be bailing out everything else, $8 trillion is what we've spent so far as a country, why we can't get some of the money to the working and middle class.
So you say it's eight. CARES was like 2.2. Are you including this massive number that went to the financial markets? Like, where did you get to eight?
Yeah, that's what I read. When you look at what both the Fed has done and what the Congress has done, and of course there were a number of other packages as well. And you sum up all of that, that is about the spending. But the American people.
Does the eight include the new 1.9 that we think will pass in March?
No. This is before
that. So it'll be 10. It'll be 10 by the time this thing gets out.
Someone should do this. Someone should have a breakdown of how much money directly went to the American people and how much did the government spend. And, you know, it makes no sense why you wouldn't have a large.
It makes no sense at all, man. I mean, I tried to do the math on the CARES Act, and you could have given every American like $6,000 for the amount that was in the CARES Act instead of what do we get? I think we got maybe $1,200.
Yeah.
Like you could have made that five times bigger and still had money to spare. So there was the bill that you and Tim championed, which I loved, the $2,000 a month bill. I think it got at least like dozens of supporters. What is the status of cash relief right now? I get the sense that Joe Biden and the team are saying $1,400 for everyone as part of this $1.9 trillion stimulus bill, I think.
Yes.
And then are there separate bills that are on the table that we can push and try and get passed into law?
Well, Tim and I still have the Emergency People Act bill. And so we're pushing right now, obviously, to get the $1,400 and not to means test it in ways. I mean, there were some people who wanted to means test it where Biden would end up giving less than the means testing that Trump was talking about. So that now is pushing off the table.
Nice work.
We'll get the $1,400. And then the question is that there's got to be something recurring. And that's the real fight, that when the next round of stimulus comes up, COVID relief comes up, can we be providing people with relief until we're past the pandemic?
Well, love this bill that you and Tim co-sponsored. How many people are on that bill? And how many people do you think we need?
We're over 50. Getting over 100 is always the magic number. And I appreciate everything you and a lot of your followers have done to build support for this.
Job number two, everyone. Emergency Money for the People Act. Get your member of Congress to sign on. If we get 50 more, then it passes the 100 mark. And then all of a sudden, you'll see articles written about it. And all these people will have to opine on it. So we're halfway there. In my mind, this stuff really should be a no-brainer because we're spending hundreds of billions of dollars on all sorts of stuff. And most of it is not falling into the hands and lives of the American people. It's very frustrating. It's like it's getting pumped into various pipes and institutions with the theoretical purpose that it will reach us, but most of it does not reach us. So if you want to have the money reach us, you can just send it to us. And Roe is trying to make that happen. So thankful to you and Tim and everyone else who's fighting for it.
No, I appreciate your push for it. And some people say, well, why do folks need it who haven't lost their jobs? I said, have you seen COVID over the last 10 months? I mean, people are having to spend more time taking care of their kids. People are having to spend more time at home. People are having to much greater burdens in terms of things they need to be able to deal in a remote economy, or others are having to cut back on hours. So it is a this is not just only the unemployed need this help. That's just
a very
myopic
way
of looking at it.
I could not agree more. Like the metaphor I use all the time, Ro, is like when the house is on fire, you turn on the fire hoses and you spray it down with water. What you don't worry about is like, oh, did some of the water splash on a part of the house that wasn't on fire? that's not the way you think about it. I mean, like we're still in the midst of a historic crisis. People are in food lines for miles. People are still losing their lives. Many people are still losing their livelihoods. I mean, I'm in New York City, and there are restaurants that have been hanging on that are now closing. So like the struggles are everywhere. And anyone who imagines that we can somehow like allocate dollars like very, very precisely only to like certain people, like it's just not realistic. It's like we're much better off driving it out to people, particularly because it's our money anyway. I mean, like we're the freaking you know, citizens, owners, and stakeholders of this economy. It's like you know, it's like whenever a company gives its shareholders dividends, and no one looks around and is like, "Oh, why did you do that?" Like there was a rich shareholder in there. Like that's not the way it works at all.
And they're going to spend it and create jobs, and that's going to bring more tax revenue back. So it's actually shown by economists to have a huge stimulus effect, a huge job creation effect. It's the right policy. It's just a matter of and now getting the political will to do it. But you've had an impact, and all because we've at least gotten direct checks. Believe it or not, that was not part of our policy before. So even though we've had only a $1,200, $600, now we'll have a $1,400 check. I mean, the fact that this was the issue in the entire Georgia Senate race. I mean, would you ever guess that they're running on $2,000 checks as the defining issue of who controls the Senate? So I say all of this because progress can be slow and painful. But to see where you were when you announced the idea of giving a monthly check and to see where we've come should give your followers and supporters a lot of optimism.
Well, certainly, I'm very grateful to everyone who supported my campaign because I feel like we helped make it happen. I'm thrilled that there are conscientious legislators like you actually writing bills and passing them to try and get money out to people.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
So now we've got everyone let members of Congress know that you care about what's happening to your data. Number two is definitely Emergency Money for the People Act. I mean, that's mission critical. That I'd say is like, you know, number one in terms of people's immediate needs. What else are you working on? Because I know there's one bill of yours I love, the Cheaters Act, but I don't know if that's like your top priority. So we'd love to hear what your number three would be.
Well, let's talk about the Cheaters Act. There are two other priorities, but the Cheaters Act is important because it's so simple. It says that you can raise $1.2 trillion in this country just by enforcing the taxes on the biggest corporations and the 1%. We're not talking about going after tax avoidance. We're not talking about clever schemes that rich people have to avoid paying tax and deductions. We're talking about actual tax evasion that is illegal, that is not being enforced by the IRS, because the IRS doesn't have the staff to audit the 1% or large corporations. They're spending their time auditing instead people who get the earned income tax credit and get $25,000 salaries are being audited at a greater rate in certain states than the wealthiest are. So the bill says, let's actually audit the people who are most likely to be evading, and that will raise $1.2 trillion. By the way, Larry Summers is idea. Larry Summers and another economics professor at Penn.
It's another no-brainer, honestly. Like the IRS's entire budget is around $10 billion. There was at least one estimate I saw that said we're leaving $400 billion in taxes on the table. So it's like, wait a minute. Like, this is what you're saying. It's like, look, if you just actually enforce the laws on the books, like you would end up generating hundreds of billions of dollars in revenue just based upon the rules as they're written now. Because right now the IRS is auditing something like a third of 1% of like the, you know, like the big companies and the highest earners. And so, you know, there's all sorts of like, you know, like people taking advantage of it. Has this bill been introduced and what are its prospects? I'm a huge fan of the Cheaters Act. I think the acronym is funny as hell too.
It's been introduced. And actually this is something I think that could unite the Democratic caucus, because look, we may disagree on whether we should have a wealth tax or not. I'm for it. We may disagree on progressive taxation, but this is just saying everyone should play by the same rules and you can raise $1.2 trillion. In fact, most rich people should be for this. You're rich and you've actually been paying your taxes, which most people actually do based on the data. Shouldn't it bother you that there are these 20-30% who are not paying taxes or hurting the country, hurting the image of those who are wealthy? So this is just about fairness. And I'm hopeful that the Biden administration gets behind this as probably the low-hanging fruit of how the Democratic Party can raise revenue. And even some Republicans may be for it.
I hope it gets passed because it's a great idea. It's just like, look, I'm not even going to argue with you about like where to draw the line. I'm just going to say we should enforce the lines as they're currently drawn. It's very, very smart. So it sounds like you had a couple of other things that are on your priority list, because this is a great list. What's number four?
Well, one is your senator and I, Schumer, and I have a bill called the Endless Frontiers, which is bipartisan. It's got Mike Gallagher, Republican Marine for Wisconsin, and Todd Young, senator from Indiana. And it is a $100 billion investment in the National Science Foundation to make it the National Science and Technology Foundation to create investments in AI so that we're not just dependent on large voluminous data AI, synthetic biology, cybersecurity, quantum computing, and of tech hubs in different parts of the country. This is, in my view, necessary for competitiveness. It's necessary for job creation. You and I have talked about the relationship with China. While we need to, in my view, be tough and smart, we also shouldn't be replicating a paradigm of a Cold War. And this is actually the way to win the 21st century. Let's actually out-compete. Let's out-innovate the rest of the world. So Schumer has said that this is a huge priority for him in the Senate. I'm pushing this in the House. This fits in with Biden's Build Back Better. And we have a real shot to get this across the finish line.
Well, I love it. Science and technology investment at the highest levels makes perfect sense. It'll pay for itself many times over in national competitiveness. A lot of our biggest innovations came out of public dollars, you know, including some of the technologies behind SpaceX and Tesla, which now everyone associates with Elon and the rest of it. But like Elon readily acknowledges, it's like, look, like, you know, like some of this stuff came out of the feds. So that's number four. That's also a slam dunk and a home run. And then you had one other that's on your mind, the fifth.
So the fifth is one of the things I did with Senator Sanders, which is we passed for the first time in the history of the country the War Powers Resolution to stop the Yemen war. President Biden, to his credit, has announced that the U.S. is going to shift policy. We're no longer going to be supporting the Saudi in their offensive bombing in Yemen. Why should people care? The country of Yemen faces a famine of unbelievable.
It's a humanitarian crisis. It's wrong. I actually just yesterday spent time with the Yemeni American community. They're lovely, wonderful people, and it has been painful for them to see what's going on in their home country. There's actually been an influx of people from Yemen because they did not want to leave Yemen, but the conflict has driven people out because people feared for their lives. So it's a humanitarian crisis, and the United States has not done enough to stop it. I mean, we have not done enough to stop it.
Yeah, man. Unfortunately, for years we've been complicit in it. We were actually supporting.
Yeah, no, I was about to say we've kind of abetted it. I thought I'd be a little bit
diplomatic, but this one, even people at the highest level of government understand that we were on the wrong side of this, and that means that we can't just wash our hands and say, okay, now that we've stopped, thanks to President Biden, let's just leave it be. We have, in my view, given the role we played, a moral obligation to help this war end. And how do we help the war end? We've got to tell the Saudis, Iran, and the UAE, all sides, to stop pouring money, stop pouring arms into Yemen, let the UN peace negotiator, Martin Griffiths, help resolve it. If it becomes a civil war in Yemen, that at least has a chance at peace. When you have all of these actors that are pouring money in, the war will never end. So Congress has played a major role here, and it's something that I'm going to continue to push for.
Thank goodness for you and Bernie pushing for this. I mean, it would be a tremendous positive if we could somehow ease the conflict in Yemen and diminish the forces that are right now fueling it.
Knowing how to speak and understand a new language can be an invaluable tool when traveling, meeting new friends, or just even to master a new skill. But it's not always simple when you're bogged down by textbooks and structure classes. That's why so many people trust Rosetta Stone. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app. It truly immerses you in the language you want to learn, like Spanish, French, Italian, Chinese, and more. You won't just be studying English translations. The Rosetta Stone intuitive process helps you pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/rs10. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/rs10 today.
So, Ro, you supported Bernie, which I appreciated a great deal, despite my joking earlier. You know, Joe won. Bernie is there in the Senate making good things happen. You're in Congress making good things happen. What is the legislative climate right now? Like, how are you feeling? How does the Progressive Caucus feel? Like, do you feel like you're going to be able to get big things done? Do you have a sense of what the administration's legislative priorities are? So you're like, oh, well, maybe we can, like, I get the sense that their next big move is going to be infrastructure after, after this COVID relief bill goes out. And I'm completely down with the fact that everything is being focused on this COVID relief bill, because, you know, like, this thing passing is job one. But yeah, like, what is the insider's point of view on what you believe like the opportunities are and the legislative climate right now?
So the Progressive Caucus actually has finally become a force, which is having an impact. I mean, there was talk, as you followed, of stripping out the minimum wage, the $15 wage, even from the House bill. We pushed back. It's going to be in the legislation, at least that clears the House. We're pushing that. We've got to get to the point where we're taking advantage of all the procedural steps to get things done. And that means, in my view, that it should be done on reconciliation. And if the parliamentarian goes against it, we should overrule the parliamentarian. Or the parliamentarian that was said that the ACA can be repealed through reconciliation and you can't give people a raise, a $15. And so that's something that we're pushing for. We're pushing to make sure we push back against the means testing on these checks so that we weren't having a cutoff that we succeeded. Biden has some good things in that $1.9 trillion. The most important, in my view, is the child tax credit, which Columbia University has said would cut child poverty in half. I mean, it's almost $3,600 for families with kids. That's an incredibly progressive policy.
That's huge. Yes.
And Biden deserves credit for having it. So I think what you see is Biden started off in my view, a pretty good place. The Progressive Caucus has had a constructive influence, and it looks like we're going to pass this on reconciliation. So we're not waiting around and diluting it for mythical Republican votes. I'm all for bipartisanship, as the Endless Frontier suggested.
No, I mean, there's a reason why I was in Georgia fighting it out, man. It's like I could see very clearly that if you had to have Mitch McConnell signing off on things or whatever, like, you know, can you imagine what this bill would even look like in that world? It would be like a completely different bill.
To give you a sense of McConnell, the fact is that we had this bill, Schumer and I, last session, and we have two Republicans. It's about science and technology investment in our competitiveness, right? It's not
it
even
should
about
be everybody,
fairness.
Sure.
It should be everyone. And McConnell wasn't willing to move that. So now when you're talking about, well, let's give working class Americans a raise, you understand the obstacles. As I often put it, if you couldn't get Donald Trump to have 60 votes of conviction in the Senate, you needed 67, but you couldn't even get 60. You understand that. I mean, those are the people you have to convince to overcome the filibuster. So that's just not realistic.
I was making the same argument to people when, like, in Georgia, some people were like, don't you want checks and balances of bipartisanship? And I was like, that is not the choice in front of you. The choice is a government that will actually be able to meaningfully respond to this crisis or not. And so if you want your government to be able to do anything, you have to get, like, these Democratic senators in. I am so pumped that Chuck Schumer is the Senate Majority Leader. I spoke to him the other day, in passing.
He's doing a great job, actually. He's really pushing the envelope and has really reached out to all of us in the Progressive Caucus and wants to be bold. He gets the moment, and he understands the arcane procedures of the Senate, which you have to understand to be effective.
Chuck seems like he's doing tremendous work. And if you can imagine from his perspective, he's been waiting for this freaking job for a while. I don't know. Now he's got it. He's trying to make the most of it, as you are trying to make the most out of your role, Ro. So people want to support you individually. Please do follow Ro on social media. He's very active. What else can people do to fuel your work, either individually or legislatively, or getting their own members of Congress excited about some of these issues?
Well, I love what you've done, Andrew, because you've inspired a movement around the country. And I think people, one, they can engage with me, and you can tweet at me, and I actually get good ideas from folks. You'll see I engage with folks. You can email me at ro@rokana.com. When you are on social media, if you're talking to your member of Congress, don't assume that they aren't going to pay attention. Let me tell you, members of Congress pay attention. So, yes, we can't go and meet members of Congress right now with the pandemic, but be active on the issues you care about on social media.
Just take that link to the Emergency Money for the People Act and just like send it to your congressman. I did that a fair amount.
What I will say is there is such creativity, there is such ingenuity outside of Washington. And I don't say, I have a lot of respect for public servants. I have a lot of respect. I don't say this as some sort of broadside against everyone in Washington. I just say that we need new thinking. We need new ideas. A lot of your supporters, volunteers have those. Send them in. I mean, almost all the good ideas I've had have come from someone else who I just listened to. And I said, okay, let's run with that. And I just think we need an infusion of that kind of thinking in Congress.
Well, that's one of the things I learned from you, Ro. When we had a conversation before, like you talked about the seniority-based system in Congress, you showed up. And I love the fact that now you're finding points of leverage where you're like, okay, how am I going to get things done, within this vast legislative body? Some people have been there 18, 20, 30 years, and the rest of it. You're the perfect combination of wanting to get a lot of stuff done and vision, but also, you're a coalition builder, you're practical, like you're going to be like, okay, like, what are the goals that I can accomplish and who can I get on board with them? I'm so grateful you're in Congress doing what you're doing. I'm grateful that it's you representing Silicon Valley. I think you're a fantastic blend of both the future regarding tech-oriented policies, but mostly like you're looking out for people, and you're trying to meld those two things. And hopefully we can make it so that it's working for both like the average person and the innovator.
Well, I appreciate that, Andrew. I feel similarly about you, and why your campaign was historic and what you're going to be doing next is it's so important. Not just because you broke every barrier as an Asian American and took it seriously at the presidential scale. By the way, that's no small feat. I mean, when I was growing up, I don't know when you were growing up, but the idea that you could have an Asian American become a major presidential candidate seemed pretty far off.
Far as, out, as even yeah. Possible. It certainly wasn't coming out up in the Yang household.
but you did something more important. I saw that when you had the math signs. I mean, you started talking about the real issues for this country. And the question is this for us. Are we going to just settle for a decline, a sense that things aren't what they used to be? Or are we going to offer a vision that, no, these next 1,500 years are going to be America's greatest? We're going to take this incredible diversity and we're going to have innovation and we're going to be inclusive and we're going to have radical equality and democracy and we're going to build something for our country that we've never seen before, a multiracial, multiethnic democracy that's working, that's innovating. And by the way, this is the model that's going to win the 21st century. We're not going to replicate Cold Wars. We're not going to replicate all the mistakes that were made of the 20th century.
Yeah, trying to learn from our mistakes from our past. Nothing would be more transformative than the Emergency Money for the People Act passing, I have to say. And really, if you're listening to this, we're 50 members of Congress away from this becoming something that's front and center. 85% of Americans are for cash relief during the pandemic. A majority are for universal basic income in perpetuity. So we just have to get more members excited about this bill, feel like it's a win for them, feel like they'll be seen looking out for people. Because everything you just described, Ro, about like us trying to build a future that's working for us, I was so pained to see that the United States of America right now is 28th in various social progress indicators. Yeah. You probably saw the same analysis. And these were things like infant mortality, clean water, public education, pretty basic stuff. And so we were 28th, and that was pre-pandemic. I have a feeling that even our relative stature has declined because we've dealt with COVID so much more disastrously than a lot of other societies. If you're looking for us to be able to actually build the society we want for the future, nothing is going to be more powerful than getting resources into people's hands. And I know that your pushing for it is dramatically increasing the chances of it happening every single day. So I just want everyone to get behind you, to be excited about you the way I am. I see you as a real kindred spirit. And, not just because we both are parents with two kids and children of immigrants and breaking various barriers, but because you and I have very similar views on both the problems of the present and what the future could be. I'm just really glad you're in Congress, man. I'm just a huge admirer of yours.
As one of my friends said to me when you were running, he said, you and Andrew are a lot alike in ways. If you just had his charisma, I said, wow, all right. And so, described as charismatic in your own way. So, I think you're going to, whatever you do next, and you're going to be part of the next generation of leadership. You've already had an incredible influence on Congress. I mean, I don't want to underestimate or put your supporters underestimate what you did. The idea of sending people checks as a response, it was laughed at initially when you put it. And now we're debating, okay, how long do we do it and what the income level is. But you've changed, right? Just like Bernie changed the debate fundamentally on Medicare for All. When he took that up, and no one was talking about it, and now it has the majority caucus. You fundamentally have changed the debate in the country on cash assistance to people, and more broadly, helping put people first in our democracy. And that's I think that's what people say, why do you do politics? When you can have an impact like that, and it's rare, and maybe doing things for years, but when that happens, there's no more gratifying feeling. I mean, it's something that's actually having an impact on people's lives.
Thank you, Ro. Well, again, it's only going to have an impact if legislators like you make it a law and the policy of the land. But I will say to you on a personal level, I was incredibly proud. I am incredibly proud of the presidential campaign. And there was part of me that was like, well, if that's like my major contribution, I'm okay with that. Like this is like a very, very worthy contribution that I've mainstreamed cash relief and universal basic income. And then you wake up the next day and then you're just like, okay, what could I do to help get it across the finish line? Oh, I should help my friend Ro. I should so it's funny. It's I appreciate the sentiment a great deal. It means a lot to me. It means a lot to a lot of the people that are listening to this. But know that we still have to go from inspiration to policy. I feel we did open a lot of people's eyes and minds and hearts. But there's still a fight ahead of us. And I really appreciate you being one of the leaders in this fight. We're going to be with you every step of the way.
I appreciate it. And I look forward to engaging and being with the movement you built every step of the way. And I guess let me reflect on what you said, because I think there was something very profound there where you said taking inspiration and making it into policy. And it's if there's one thing I've learned in my four now going on 5 years in D.C., it's how hard that is. I thought the hard thing building the inspiration. And that's a necessary. Without that, you can't even get started. But even when you have the mobilized inspiration, it's amazing to me how many things don't move in Washington. And it's not always corruption in the way you think of it. I was telling someone, I won't mention who, but there was one bill of mine that was clearly obvious. And it was a person, one staff person in one committee who didn't like it and wanted to kill the whole thing. So there are so many ways in Washington to say no. There's so many ways to kill an idea. There's so much risk aversion in how we operate, that it's a Herculean feat to do anything major. But when it happens, when you do have sustained mobilization that isn't just a presidential campaign, but continues to fight, which you've done for cash relief, then you see that things can get done and can change. And so I have admiration for your supporters that they've stuck with this, stuck with you, and have gotten more engaged, more involved after your campaign than just saying, okay, we did our thing and we made our contribution to this country.
I've learned from you what the actual obstacles are in terms of getting some of these bills passed. Is this going to be in your book? Because I would love to read like chapters and chapters about like some of your experiences in Congress.
I'm going to have some of it. I try to focus on the ideas, but I do think people probably would want to know some of the actual obstacles in legislation. I think that is so. Maybe I'll include that.
You totally should, and you should know that that's where my head is going, Ro, is because I'm reflecting on the fact that, look, if 55% of us are for universal basic income, problem solved, right? And then it's like problem not solved at all because of the stuff that you're describing. It's like you have to get into the machinery itself to figure out what it would take.
And some of the checks, I mean, if you put aside, look, there's obviously some issues of the powerful have way too much of a voice and special interests and lobbyists. But there's another fundamental issue, which is it's a difference between a startup and IBM. And there's a reason that IBM has all these safeguards, because they're wealthy and successful and they don't want to take risks that are too crazy. And so some of it is understandable. But here's the challenge for us. We're, as America, we're the IBM, but we're living in a world where just being the IBM isn't going to be good enough to be competitive. Yep. And yep. The IBM has a lot of underlying problems that need structural reform. So we need government reform, not just of saying, okay, I'm against the special interests and I'm against the lobbyists. We need actual fundamental reform that allows us to make decisions.
You are one of like the best situated people to figure out how to actually turn our IBM into a 21st century government. So count me in. That to me is our next challenge. Like, it's the mechanics, it's the plumbing. It's like if you have all this energy coming into machinery that is not responsive or not aligned or not adapting, you're just going to get frustrated. So that to me has to be where our focus is. So I'm going to be picking your brain a lot. I urge you definitely to include this in your book. When the book does come out, we'll have you back on so everyone can make sure to get a copy. So excited that you are there fighting the good fight, my friend, and we'll do everything we can to help.
Thank you, Andrew, and I look forward to your implementing your 21st century vision of government and excited to be partnering with you for the long run.
You got it, brother. I will see you soon. Thank you so much, Ro.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.